Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When you visit New Orleans, you probably won't see any obvious remembrance of the largest uprising of African slaves in American history. You can find there Claiborne Avenue, however, named for William C.C. Claiborne, the first governor of the state of Louisiana, who found it politically expedient to cover up the true story of the slave revolt of 1811. You'll also find a street named for Gilbert Andre and another named for Francois Trepanier, who two martyred white victims of the slave revolt. But the leaders of the revolt, their memories almost were entirely lost to history. Daniel Rasmussen, who graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard University in 2009, has reclaimed their stories. His book, American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt, began as his senior thesis at Harvard and has now been published and become a New York Times bestseller. He's with us to talk about the book. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks so much, Ann. It's wonderful to be on.
New Orleans, it was a complex soup of French, Spanish, and British white planters, and also a mixture of American, Haitian, Congolese, and other West African cultures among the slave population. And leaders there were already concerned with attempts to Americanize the region, even as they worked to achieve statehood. There was just a lot going on at that time.
Absolutely. You know, 70% of the population or so is African, you know, slaves brought over from Africa. The white population is 90% French and Spanish. And so you have William Claiborne, who's the governor appointed by Thomas Jefferson, who comes in after the Louisiana Purchase, and he's trying to make New Orleans American. It's America's first sort of imperial colony. People are not particularly excited about American authority. The French planters are very, very wealthy, autonomous, and they have little, they call Claiborne an ignorant yahoo, and that's sort of their perception of him. And you have Spanish troops all around because Spain controls everywhere from Florida, Alabama, present-day Alabama, Texas, Cuba. And in addition, you've just got this, you know, seething resentment in the slave quarters over the, you know, terrible mistreatment that's going on in these sugar plantations.
What was it about the sugar plantations that made them so much, I mean, it brutal along a continuum, of course, but more brutal or considered more brutal than other contemporary plantation operations in the regular, what we think of as probably the more normalized South?
Yep, the sugar is the worst possible thing you can do as a slave is to work on a sugar plantation. When slaves refer to being sold south or sold down the river, they meant being sold down to New Orleans and being put to work in these sugar plantations. Sugar is incredibly labor-intensive, and one of the reasons for that is that basically the sugar gets richer and richer the longer you keep the sugar in the ground. But the first frost will kill the entire crop. So the planters are playing this dangerous game where they want to wait as long as possible to harvest it, and then they want to harvest it all as quickly as possible. And then they have to have this simultaneously running this sort of industrial process of granulation with these huge boiling kettles and this sort of factory on each plantation to process the sugar. And so you see slaves during the harvest season, you know, which lasts, you know, all fall. The slaves are working, they're asked to be slaves working 24 hours a day, and so they work in, will work 3 8-hour shifts a day and then sleep for 8 hours. And you know, different slaves are in different rotations. And there's just incredible violence used to keep, you know, the 40 to 100 slaves on each plantation working around the clock, doing this back-breaking labor, especially given the, you know, tropical climate and really terrible, you know, conditions in those fields.
My guest is Daniel Rasmussen. He is the author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. If you have a question or comment for Dan, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, the demographics of the slave population, were they any different? Because it was such backbreaking work, they did it tend toward more younger, stronger male slave populations at that time?
Oh, yes. So, you know, the Atlantic slave trade is still open, or it's just closed, actually, by 1811, but, you know, was open until 1808, and there's still a lot of illegal importation of African slaves. So you have a very young, very male population, many of whom are straight off the boat from Africa, and you have a really, you know, diverse group of slaves because of that. You have people that were born in Louisiana, Virginia, Kentucky. But you also have slaves born in Haiti, Jamaica, the Akan Kingdom, the Congo, et cetera, And so they're bringing, you know, a real breadth of experience and knowledge and cultures of resistance to play here.
Right. Those cultures of resistance were from West Africa as well as from Haiti.
Absolutely. And so, you know, you have, you know, Africa is in turmoil at this point. It's been thrown into a series of wars that are being fought, largely fueled by European trade and slaves and other commodities. You also have the inspiration of Haiti, which, you know, I think we think of Haiti today. We see those images on the television. But back then, Haiti was a symbol, a beacon of hope for slaves all over the world, because Haiti was the first successful slave revolt in the history of the New World.
They weren't literate, though, were they? They were storytellers.
Yes. Very few of them would have been literate.
And their goal in this case, because of that kind of that backdrop of revolt in Africa and in Haiti, it wasn't about escaping anything. It was about taking over.
Absolutely. So there's only one slave once who the planters ask, why did you do this? And he says, I went to the city to kill all the whites. And so certainly violence was the first thing that had to happen. And violence is endemic to this world, the Atlantic world. It's a constant. And so, you know, first, violence. Second, you know, what did they intend to do after that? And I think they can only have intended to establish a black republic a la Haiti here on the shores of the Mississippi River. And you can see that by a number of different things, by the military uniforms they use, by their chants, by the, you know, presence of Haitians among them. But when you think about what happens in a successful slave revolt, the template for that is Haiti, where victorious black Haitians, after defeating the armies of Napoleon Bonaparte, declare imperialism illegal, declare racism illegal, abolish slavery, and establish a black republic just a few hundred miles from the coast of the United States.
But the big difference was it was isolated. It was an island, and that wasn't the case here. 614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation. And Abdul from Columbus, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. It's a great show. I have a quick comment and a question. My comment is that I think we can look back to history and take advantage and teach our future generations that we can correct our mistakes, especially the Afro-Americans. To recognize the opportunity that they have, not similar to their predecessors or their fathers. So if they look at back their history and recognize the opportunity that they have right now, I believe they have a lot to achieve. And my question is that, is Don, I have read many books about the history of slaves, and I have seen some of the mention that those slaves brought from Africa to North America, 30% of them were Muslim. And I was wondering, out of the 70% of Africans in New Orleans, which I used to live, actually, I went to my first college there called the Delgado Community College. So out of that 70% of the Africans in New Orleans, what percentage do you think were Muslims? And I take the answer of the radio.
Thanks for the call, Abdul.
Thanks. Yep. Yep. So, you know, I don't have an exact percentage for you, but you certainly do see a significant Muslim population here in the slave quarters in New Orleans, which is one thing that makes this all the more interesting. You know, it's just the diversity of perspectives that these men are bringing from Africa to bear here in New Orleans.
The three men at the center, and correct my pronunciations if they're wrong, Charles Delandes.
Deland,
and he was an overseer on one of the plantations, and Harry Kenner was a carpenter.
Yep.
And Kwamana is from West Africa, I believe.
Yep.
They were very different from each other. How did they get together?
Yep. So you have, I think, you know, Charles Deland, who's you know, one of the leaders we know the most about. He's a slave driver on Manuel Andrews' plantation. He's the son of a white planter and an enslaved mother. And he has risen up on his plantation to be a driver, which is, you know, there's the master, the overseer, and the driver, and he carries the whip and the keys. He punishes the other slaves. He meets with the planter every day to plot out the crop cycles. Other slaves would have thought men like Charles were, you know, the ultimate betrayers of the race, you know, people who are complicit with the system of slavery and in return were rewarded with better clothes, better But Charles was using his privileged position not to further the system of slavery, but to undermine it. And he, you know, in our modern terminology, is the ultimate sleeper cell. And Charles would travel up and down the German coast meeting with these other men. You had Cook and Quamana, recently brought over from Africa in 1806. They were a Khan, you know, children of a warlike empire. Cook or Kwaku is over 6 feet tall, just this looming figure. And then you have Harry Kenner, who is, you know, very close into the city. He's an Anglo-American slave. He speaks English. And these guys are coming together, despite their ethnic differences, to launch this revolt. And so, you know, what brought these guys together, you know, people of such diverse backgrounds?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't, you know, it's hard to tell. The slaves, you know, didn't take notes, and we don't have much left of you know, what they wrote down. But I think, you know, the common forge would have been, you know, a couple of things. One is just that, you know, the experience of slavery here on the German coast, which is very particular, very violent. There's a lot of movement and interaction between the slaves and different plantations. And so I think these men would have gotten to know each other through, you know, that experience of slavery, and they shared that bond. But there's also a vibrant, you know, African community, an African-American community here in New Orleans. There were dances that would be held in the city. There were taverns along the levee. You know, there were places you could meet in the swamps. There were these colonies of escaped slaves that lived in the swamps. And so there is an underground culture of resistance that is, you know, implicit in all of these activities. And so it's, I think, through that community that these men would have come to know each other.
Not literate, but highly intelligent?
Absolutely. You know, these men, New Orleans does not exist without slaves. Slaves are absolutely essential to the way that New Orleans is built. And John Noel Destraham, one of the most prominent planters, writes that without slavery, cultivation must cease, the improvements of a century be destroyed, and the great river resume its empire over our ruined fields and demolished habitations. You know, men like Charles are, you know, Charles Delon is really running a plantation of, you know, 40 to 100 men. He's like a general. Incredibly sophisticated organizational skills, which he then brings to bear in this revolt. And these men are also bringing, you know, West African agricultural techniques, you know, organizational abilities, and they're constantly moving and talking. And you know, this revolt and the ability to plan such a massive uprising in the face of tremendous oppression is just one more sign of just how intelligent, sophisticated these slaves really were.
We have to take a break. My guest is Daniel Rasmussen. He is the author of American Uprising, the untold story of America's largest slave revolt. It occurred in New Orleans before Louisiana was a state. If you have any questions or comments, we welcome them, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also get to us via the All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. It's currently 52 degrees in downtown Columbus with some light rain. Showers and thunderstorms are likely today. Thunderstorms especially after 2 o'clock this afternoon, a high near 64. A slight chance of rain tonight and a low of 48 degrees. And then partly sunny tomorrow and a high of 72.
Support for 89.7 comes from Catco, presenting What the Butler Saw, a comedy by Joe Orton. On stage March 30th through April 17th in Studio One at the Rife Center. Tickets and more information at catco.org.
ArtZine is WOSU Public Media's magazine on the web. At wosu.org/artzine, read articles about the latest arts and culture news in Columbus. ArtZine also features video stories highlighting some of the best artists in Central Ohio. Visit wosu.org/artzine to find out more. And All Sides continues.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Daniel Rasmussen. He is the author of American Uprising, the untold story of America's largest slave revolt. Daniel is a graduate of Harvard University, where he prepared most of his research during his undergraduate years for his undergraduate thesis. If you have a question for him, you can call 614 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Colin, you're an OSU grad student. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann and Daniel. Daniel, this is a fascinating and exciting study. As it happens, I'm an OSU grad student, and I will be teaching my class this morning about slave resistance and revolt in the early republic. And so it's perfect timing. And I wonder if you could discuss a little bit how this study is going to change the way we teach that, and maybe contrast it a little bit with the Denmark Vesey conspiracy or Nat Turner's revolt. And also the connections, this Atlantic world connection, right? The Republicans are very nervous about, you know, refusing to recognize Haiti and afraid that this sort of thing, the Haitian Rebellion, is going to foment revolt in the States. And so what have you found in terms of this Atlantic connection, people traveling back and forth from Haiti or being able to actually get into slave communication networks? I'll take my question off here. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Colin.
Well, thank you very much. I'm thrilled that you're going to be talking about the book with your student. You know, in comparison to other slave resistance, I think what can this tell us? I think, first of all, you know, this gives us some insight into just the political aspirations of American slaves, that these were men and women coming together across all sorts of ethnic lines with what is explicitly a political agenda, right? Unlike many other revolts, you know, we don't see a real religious influence here. You see these men marching in military uniform, flying flags, beating drums, shouting on to New Orleans and freedom or death, and taking advantage of, you know, an international Atlantic political situation, which is that in the fall of 1810, America is waging a war with Spain over Baton Rouge. They are fighting Spanish troops, and the slaves are keenly aware that the best time to launch a revolt is when there is an international political situation to distract the prevailing power. So you see slaves taking advantage of international political currents, organizing across ethnic lines. And so we see a real insight into just how sophisticated, politically motivated these slaves were. In terms of your second question, you know, which revolves around their sort of Atlantic connections, you know, these slaves are from all over the world, and they are certainly very clued in to, you know, the cross currents of Atlantic resistance. They know about Haiti. A few years before, they found a copy of, you know, Declaration of the Rights of Man in the slave quarters. These slaves not only are in contact with the traders and the sailors and the slaves being brought into the port of New Orleans, but are listening to their masters' conversations, are aware of those political topics of discussion. And so you really, you know, I think that this gives us some insight into a highly sophisticated, complex slave culture right here in New Orleans, and men who are able to take advantage of that political culture to launch what is has gone down in history as the largest act of slave resistance in American history.
Jack from Dayton, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Daniel. Hi, Ann. Good morning. My question would be, based on religion and not knowing the history that much myself, especially black history, were black slaves at that time Christianized, and was that a question for them to be able to revolt having a Christian teaching, if that was actually part of their reality at that moment in history?
You don't see, you know, as much of a Christian culture here in New Orleans at the time, because most of these slaves are just recently arrived from Africa, you know, and because ultimately there's not much of an incentive for the planters. The planters do baptize many of the slaves, but beyond that, they really haven't, you know, focused on using religion as a mode of sort of enforcing, you know, their culture or the system of slavery on their slaves. And so you see, you know, I think they would have been largely influenced by African traditions, by voodoo. But, you know, there's some Islamic and some Christian elements there, to be sure. But you don't see sort of the widespread Christian influence that you'd see, you know, 50 years later.
Can I follow up on that? Or?
Sure.
Yep.
Well, I guess that's, you know, we obviously know that intelligence is like talent is spread across to all mankind and all continents. But if they were being taught Christianity, they wouldn't really know what that was if they weren't literate. They would only know intelligently that they're being told there's some divine being, and they're enslaved under these people who believe in that divine being. How did that how did that coalesce for them as they actually became literate and learned about Christianity?
You know, at this point, you know, it's such an early stage in the development of slave culture in New Orleans. You know, it's really, you know, very African. You know, the planters are focused, you know, in terms of, you know, how they enforce the system of slavery. They're doing that through whips, through torture devices, through incredible violence, and not so much through probably what I would say were those softer forms of enforcement and oppression, which were trying to, you know, force the slaves to participate in their own religious activities. So you don't see as much of that Christian influence here as you would later.
Thanks, Jack. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and speak with our guest, Dan Rasmussen. He's author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. Just real quickly, Dan, what was the prominent religion that was kept among particularly the French plantation owners? Was it Catholic?
Yes, they were Catholic.
Yeah.
Yep.
The subtitle uses the phrase, the largest slave revolt. But it's actually unclear exactly how many slaves participated in the revolt, which wasn't unusual. I mean, there weren't a lot of records keeping of any of the slave revolts that are really well known in history. There are always some, you know, from this to that number. But why the discrepancy in this case? It was anywhere from a 200 to 500, you've estimated.
Yep. So those are just, you know, accounts from eyewitnesses. And sort of the lowest number that eyewitnesses record is 200, and the highest is 500. But either way, you know, Nat Turner's revolt at its largest was 100 slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, no matter which way you look at it, you know, this was 2 to 5 times the size of the next largest slave revolt. You know, it's hard to get a precise number. They kill about 100 slaves, which is, you know, probably 2 or 3 times the amount of slaves that are killed in Nat Turner's revolt. So this is just massive, and it's hard to understate the size of this uprising.
And I guess the idea that we've already talked about how valuable the slaves were, not just as property, but as absolute necessity to do the job that had to be done very quickly at a very specific time when it came to harvesting the sugar, to kill 100 of them.
Yep.
Was a huge statement. I mean, and I was wondering, when they killed them, did they split it up among the plantations? I mean, how did they go about even deciding, or was it out of complete anger? And
yep, you know, well, they after the revolt, you know, they kill about 40 to 60 of them right in this battle that, mm-hmm. that occurs in the cane fields. And then after that, they hunt down anyone they can that they think was involved, and they kill them all. They behead them. They put their heads on poles, and they put those poles along the levee from the center of the city out 40 miles. And so I think often people think and ask that sort of question, well, you know, these slaves were so valuable, it's so profitable to own a slave, you know, why would you maim, physically injure, you know, or kill one of your own slaves?
Or any more than you had to.
Right, given that, you know, their value. And the answer, right, exactly is that they had to, because the slaves are so resistant to the system of slavery. And in this case, these revolutionaries were about to kill, you know, all the white people in New Orleans and overthrow the government. And so you see that level of violence that you see in slave societies is an indication of the level of resistance and just what these planters had to do to turn men into slaves.
I guess kind of the capitalist notion of you got to spend money to make money.
Exactly.
Regardless of the size of it, though, most of the slaves chose not to fight. Was that because they weren't invited, or were there conflicts among the slave groups at the time? There weren't a lot of families. Were there because there were so many? It was mostly men.
Yep. So, you know, slavery is not, you know, not monolithic, and the slaves have various different motivations, desires, aspirations. And so about 25% of the slaves on these plantations rise up, choose to join the revolt. About, you know, 74% choose not to, and then about 1% choose actively to betray the revolt. And so those portion that choose actively to betray it do so because the fastest way to freedom in a slave society is not to participate in a revolt, but to betray one. The planters guarantee freedom to slaves that betray revolt. And so a few, you know, it looks like, you know, 2 or 3 slaves over the course of this revolt choose to betray the revolutionaries, help their masters escape, warn them, and are thus rewarded with their freedom in the wake of the revolt. Most of the others, I think, are conscious of the, you know, tremendous danger of launching a revolt. You know, they live in a world that's dominated by these white planters. They know the size of the American military, you know, in the presence of other militaries in the region. And I think they're making a conscious calculation that, you know, they're not going to join this revolt because they don't want to die. And they're afraid. You know, I think that that's a very rational decision to make.
We had a caller that couldn't stay on the phone. It was Steve from Columbus. He asked, is it true that a number of freed slaves went on to become slave owners themselves?
You know, that is true, that there are occasionally in the story of the South freed slaves that do go on to become slave owners. But the clear reality behind, you know, that distinguishes those freed slaves from other people tends to be that the vast, vast majority of those freed slaves who become slave owners are children of white planters. And so the planters free their own, you know, sons and then, you know, establish their sons as planters themselves. You don't really see, you know, you don't see planters freeing, you know, random slaves. You know, it usually is because there's this tight familial connection. And that's one thing, you know, you have to look at with, you know, Wendell Phillips, the great abolitionist, calls the South one great brothel. There's a lot of interracial intimacy, and many, many children of the planters are, you know, slaves, and some of those do become free.
The first plantation that they attacked in the revolt was the Andrey operation, which is where they stole weapons and horses and also uniforms. And you got a little bit into the uniforms, but why were the uniforms there? And really, this was a huge symbol to them then.
Yeah, so the Manuel Andrey is a member of the local militia, and so he has a stockpile of weapons as well as uniforms on his plantation. The slaves break into that stockpile, put on these uniforms, steal the weapons. And what they're saying when they put on those uniforms is they're saying, you know, we're not slaves anymore. Now we're free, and not only are we free, but we're putting on these uniforms to show that we are a real political organization, that we're willing to fight for our freedom, and that we will not be considered slaves either by our peers or by the planters anymore. And so they're consciously evoking, you know, also the imagery of the Haitian Revolution, where, you know, you see, you know, black men in military uniform who, you know, take over the government.
Again, it was political, not escapism.
Exactly, right? If it was escapism, they would have marched towards Spanish territory, but they don't. They marched towards New Orleans, and that's very significant and very telling of their intention.
Now, one white planter managed to survive and escape to warn the others, but you said that other slaves also spilled the beans.
Yep. So as soon as the revolt begins, there's, you know, one slave in particular named Dominique who tells his master, Francois Trepanier, that the rebels are coming. You need to escape. Francois then sends Dominique to warn every single plantation from his plantation to New Orleans. And so, you know, that one slave, you know, Dominique, actually is responsible really for saving the lives of, you know, many planters and their children and families.
614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call and speak with our guest, Daniel Rasmussen. He is the author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you want to post a question or comment there. Now, the American officials and the French planters who fought the slave, I guess I call them slave militia, in the question here, but covered up the true story of the revolt, and they succeeded for a long time up until recently. Why did they try to cover it up instead of publicizing their victory over the slaves, a la the, you know, decapitated heads of the revolutionaries put on the spikes? I mean, at first they were publicizing it.
Yep. So, you know, they are, in the form of these dismembered bodies, are publicizing the story to the slaves in the form of what, you know, they're saying, don't mess with us or we'll kill you and we'll ritually dishonor your corpses. But, you know, there's another audience which they're speaking to, which is the rest of the nation, right? Louisiana is being considered for statehood in the legislature in Washington, D.C. at this very moment. And these planters and William Claiborne are keenly worried about the way that they will be perceived. William Claiborne does not want his name to go down as the governor who presided over the largest slave revolt in American history. And these planters don't want to go down as, you know, brutal, you know, torturers who are willing to, you know, inflict this terrible violence on their slaves. And so you know, they try to write a new narrative of this revolt, which is that it was an insignificant uprising, easily suppressed, that it was not revolutionaries, that these were slaves were mere brigands or criminals who were just, you know, looting and rioting. So, you know, they're trying to undermine and ignore a very important idea, and that is the idea that the slaves were human, and that not only were they human, but they had real political aspirations that ran counter to the system of plantation slavery and to the, you know, expanding American plantation system. And that idea of the slaves' humanity, of their political aspirations, was a fundamental challenge to the system of plantation slavery. And there's a terror among the planters, you know, that ideology will spread to other slaves in other regions, and that ideology will, you know, become, you know, not only a genesis for other slave revolts, but a genesis for political opposition to the system of slavery, to the system of plantation slavery, and ultimately to Louisiana statehood.
I guess beware the victor's version of history, right?
Absolutely.
614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and speak with our guest, Daniel Rasmussen. And Lawrence from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, my name is Lawrence. I actually come from Sierra Leone. You may have heard of the Amistad Revolt. I was wondering, even though it was to, you know, escape from slavery, compared to the political one that took place in Louisiana, was there any connection? Did the slaves who revolted in Louisiana might have heard of what happened on the Amistad?
Yep. So I you know, they might well have heard of it. I don't see, you know, I haven't seen any evidence of that.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, this actually, sorry, to correct that. So the Amistad revolt takes place in 1839, and this revolt takes place in 1811. So, you know, it just temporally, they obviously couldn't have known about something that happened in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Lawrence. I guess Lawrence is gone. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. We have to take a break right now. My guest is Daniel Rasmussen, author of American Uprising, the Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Last week on Car Talk, we demonstrated our usual sensitivity to callers with serious car problems.
All right, well, you're done for. All right, well, get it flushed out. In fact, after they flush it, ask them to flush it a second time, just to make sure.
Okay.
And maybe you'll get lucky.
All right, thanks.
Not with the car, maybe in some other way. Don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for Car Talk.
And Car Talk tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, All Sides Weekend begins with 89.7 NPR News host Marilyn Smith and a discussion of the best books and reading for spring. Join us beginning at 11 for All Sides Weekend.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing companionship, dementia, Alzheimer's, and hospice support. More at 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead. To us, it's personal.
And it's 52 degrees with some light rain in downtown Columbus. Expect rain off and on throughout the day. Maybe a thunderstorm, especially after 2 o'clock this afternoon. And then a chance of rain tonight as well, a low of 48 degrees. But a beautiful weekend in store ahead of us here. Partly sunny for Saturday and a high of 72. And partly sunny on Sunday with a high of 84. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dan Rasmussen. He's written a new book. It's called American Uprising, the Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. The revolt occurred in New Orleans back in 1811. If you have a question or comment for Dan, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Amy from Franklin Park, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question, I've read the book and I've been hearing you talking today. And everything that I read really talks about the diversity in this group of slaves. They're from Haiti, they're from Africa, they have different religious backgrounds, they're coming from different linguistic backgrounds, and these people have managed to put all of those things aside and form a group to work for their better good. Obviously, in this example, it's through violence, but do you see any way that we can learn currently with what's going on in the world from this example of how to put things like religion, color, different backgrounds and things aside to work for political gain overall like these people did?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that most inspired me about this story, and one of the things, honestly, that made me write this book was just how inspirational that story is, which is that these people, you know, these men and women on these plantations are able to cross all of those boundaries, ethnic, political, religious, and why. Ultimately, the reason why is because of their belief in the need for freedom and equality, you know, for those basic human rights. In the face of an incredibly oppressive system of slavery, and I think, you know, and this is, you know, my personal political philosophy, but I think that belief in freedom and equality and in basic human rights is so transcendent, and you see that just across the world. You know, it's so inspiring for me to look at what's going on in Egypt and in Libya, and to see just how fundamental that desire for liberty really is. And so, you know, I see these slaves, in Charles de Lannes and Cook and Kwamana, you know, really a testament to the best ideals of this nation and what this nation has always stood for, which is, you know, freedom and equality. But ultimately, you know, the irony as well of just how often we sacrifice those ideals. And here in America, you know, Charles de Lannes and Cook and Kwamana, you know, who, you know, believed in those ideals were killed, executed, their bodies dismembered. And so, you know, that's actually one of the ironies I tried to call attention to in titling this book, American Uprising, and to think about how we think about these men both as American and as people who were brutally suppressed by the American government.
Amy, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to give us a call, we have a few more minutes left with Dan Rasmussen, author of American Uprising. I was going to ask you about the American Uprising reference. It's very specific, obviously, a title always will be, but I'm glad you explained that. The slaves never forgot the revolt, no matter, you know, regardless of what the white controllers of history did. They never forgot it, and they passed it down from generation to generation, and that's pretty much how it survived. How did you pick up on it, Dan?
Yeah, so, you know, first of all, you know, it is really amazing how well-preserved the memory of this uprising is on the German coast even today. When I went down to talk about this book, there was a woman that stood up and asked me a question. She said, you know, it's amazing that nobody else in the country knows this, but I just wanted to say that I've heard about this in my family reunions for years. And there are community groups, really amazing groups in Louisiana that have worked to collect documents, to assemble documents, to, you know, bring to life the story of this revolt, you know, in their community. And I and many other scholars are really indebted to the work of those community groups. In terms of how I came upon this, you know, it's mentioned ever since Herbert Aptheker's 1943 book, American Negro Slave Revolt. This uprising has been acknowledged as the largest revolt in American history. The most scholarly monographs on slavery will reference this, but almost none of them know anything about it. And so, you know, frequently that, you know, it'll be described as the least well-documented slave revolt in American history, or as, you know, it happened in New Orleans, largest revolt, we don't know anything about it. And that sort of got my hackles up. You know, I'd been trained in investigative journalism. That was sort of my background. And I saw that, and I said, well, you know, geez, there's got to be a story there. And so I just started to dig in and try to learn more. And what I found, you know, was just so exciting. You know, I'm a 24-year-old guy. My favorite movie, you know, is Braveheart. And I was so inspired, you know, to read this story about, you know, really heroic resistance to oppression here on American soil, and a story of resistance that had been suppressed, covered up, written out of the history books. Thus, you know, both kind of prompting my sort of outrage of, you know, geez, I got to write this story and correct that amnesia, but also my, you know, excitement that I could contribute and share that story with a broader audience.
So it was, there was little or no written record of the revolt. How did you decide to fill the gaps?
Yep. So, you know, when I first started, I actually started as my junior paper. And, you know, when I started reading, you know, the primary sources, for the first level of them, the newspaper accounts and the letters, which are form the basis for, you know, basically every other historian's, you know, sparse work on this uprising. You know, I thought, you know, did this revolt even happen? Because the descriptions, you know, suggested that it was so insignificant, that it was easily suppressed, da-da-da. And so I decided, you know, well, let's dig down to the next level of sources, which are the court transcripts, the financial records of the planters themselves, and military and diplomatic correspondence, which, you know, that was an arduous task finding that. I, you know, among other things, you know, spent a few days in D.C. going to the National Archives looking at the records of every single ship that had been anywhere near New Orleans within 5 years of 1811 to see if they had records of this. And I did found one wonderful letter which described the revolt in detail. But ultimately what I had to do was take all that financial information in those court transcripts, which are in list form. Financial records say, you know, Charles was a driver on the Andrea estate worth $800. And the court transcripts say things like, you know, Cook denounced Quamana as an infamous brigand. And to take those lists and put them into databases, so into Excel databases, because, you know, to process this sort of financial information, the best tools we have available today are the tools we use to do financial analysis, which is Excel. Once I had, you know, this database built, I mapped the databases onto old land maps. So I was literally in the library with crayons saying, you know, if there were 5 slaves that came from this plantation, I'll call it orange. If there were 10 slaves, I'll call it red. And so I have this visual sense of how and where things happen. And then I used, you know, since I know when certain events happened, you know, from the military and diplomatic correspondence, I could say, well, I know this happened at 9 a.m. here, and I can use Google Maps to figure out how long it would have walked from point A to point B. And so this other event must have happened, you know, 4 hours earlier, and so it must have happened then. And so then to take, you know, having mapped the database onto the land maps, then to use these sort of temporal markers and Google Maps, et cetera, to figure out when things happened, and then, you know, build this really granular, you know, step-by-step narrative of when and where things happened. And that was just such an arduous process. And I think ultimately, you know, the difficulty for me of doing that process is the reason why, you know, so few other scholars have really, you know, done any work on this revolt.
614-292-8513. We have a few more minutes left with Dan Rasmussen, author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. If you have a question or comment, get that in quickly. Some have criticized the work, Dan, as too much conjecture. The Cleveland Plain Dealer, on the other hand, noted your conjectures as carefully wrought and based on the most fragmentary evidence are shrewd illustrations, they wrote, of the historian's art. What did you learn about being a historian and sharing these kinds of stories that, you know, and doing what you did, you know, all that data crunching that you did, how did you turn that into prose? How did you turn it into a story?
Yeah, well, that's a problem we face with slave history is that no matter how hard you try, no matter how much you research you do, in this case, you're not going to find anything written by the slaves because the slaves, in this case, were largely illiterate. You're not going to find anything more than the sort of refracted viewpoints of the slaves found through what their masters thought the slaves themselves were saying. And so in order to, you know, I think your choices are to say, well, let's just give up and take the planters seriously. You know, and just trust them that they were right, or do the sort of detective work, the parallel histories, building that sort of legal case of sort of here in the absence, which will always be an absence, of direct textual sources. How do we deal with those gaps? And the way I chose to deal with it was to confront it head on and say, you know, I refuse to just take the planters literally, and instead I'm going to do the best I can to tell the story from the slave's perspective, even though that is in some sense an impossible task. And so that does that require conjecture? Yes, but it requires informed conjecture, which is to say, if I don't know what the slaves right here, right now, thought, let's read everything written by slaves for 30 years from any, you know, reasonably close by slave societies and figure out how more generally, you know, what common themes what ideas were permeating the slave quarters at the time, and thus use those parallel stories to inform my study of this revolt. And so that was ultimately sort of how I went about this, just as a detective, you know, sort of saying, you know, without knowing, and we'll never know, what exactly these men thought, you know, how can we work, you know, and I'll do the work for the reader of reading all this other material and then synthesizing it into being able to say, you know, this is my best judgment, given all that I've read and all the work I've done about mm-hmm. what they would have thought, how they would have felt, you know, in the cases where we'll never know.
You've explained your inspiration. You've explained your methodology. What did you learn from all of this in the final analysis?
You know, ultimately, I think, you know, and one thing I really want people to take away from my book is that, you know, I sort of grew up, you know, when we studied slavery, you know, it was sort of, you know, I was sort of taught to feel very guilty and ashamed and to cringe from the memory of slavery and to think of the slaves really ultimately as victims. And, you know, as I did my work on this revolt and wrote the book, you know, I think what I realized is that we have to rethink that because the slaves, yes, they were victims, but they were also heroes. You know, not only did these men and women, you know, build America really from an economic perspective, you know, cotton is the number one U.S. export from 1800 to 1930, but they were also men who fought and died for liberty. And that story was inspiring to me and I think helped me change the way I think about slavery and to start thinking about the slaves not as victims but as heroes. And I think, you know, when you look at the way, you know, in our popular memory, we think of the French Resistance or the Scottish under William Wallace.
Or the Revolutionary War.
We think about them in such positive terms, and we remember their fights and battles for freedom, you know, in ways that, you know, a nine-year-old guy, you know, could go pick up a book and feel excited about it. But, you know, slavery is not taught that way. It's not remembered that way. And that's one of the things I wanted to accomplish with this book, is to say we can remember these slaves and their resistance and their stories of resistance as heroism, as ingenious, as exciting, and thus sort of rethink the way we think about slavery more broadly.
Mike from Marion, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a couple of short comments and a question. Okay. Author referred to the slaves as heroes, and I know he means the very best sense of the term, but I think the word is so overused these days and misapplied that it just doesn't do a lot for me. The second thing is that I heard a wonderful comment by a caller it might have been your show once in the past, who very thoughtfully observed that these people might better be called the enslaved rather than slaves. The slave term being a little harsh and almost applying some level of blame to their condition, whereas the enslaved puts the onus squarely where it belongs.
Yeah, I've heard that it can dehumanize.
Exactly, mm-hmm. I know this isn't meant, but still, it might change the way we think about it. And my question is, what did it cost, if you can? This is off subject, but can you come up with an estimate in today's dollars of the total cost, annual cost of operating? Oh, that's harsh too. But having a slave work for you, maybe in terms of the total cost of the sugar or cotton produced in a year, I'd like to get a handle, if possible, on what they spent in terms of today's dollars in order to maintain this horrendous system.
Yep. And
I'll take the answer off the air, please.
Thanks, Mike.
Yep, I'll answer those questions in reverse order. In terms of the cost, slave cost about $800 in, you know, 1811 dollars, which is roughly $30,000 in today's dollars. And so you can think of the slave roughly as the price of a car. And so there's variation in the quality, you know, of a slave. You know, some slaves were worth more, older or weaker, you know, sicker slaves are worth less, but roughly the price of, you know, a high-quality car. And they recoup, you know, a slave earns about $250 a year in sugar. And so, you know, you can think about a slave recouping their initial investment in 4 years, doubling their investment in 8 years. An average lifespan of a slave brought over from Africa and start, you know, put to work in these plantations lives 7 years. And so it's profitable to work a slave to death in under 10 years. You know, the next question, you know, I take your point, and I think that, you know, it is valuable to write and think about the you know, these people as enslaved people rather than as slaves. You know, but I was reading a wonderful essay by David Foster Wallace over the weekend, and one of the points he made is that, you know, when we distract ourselves by arguments over semantics, you know, whether to refer to people as slaves or enslaved people, we distract ourselves from the fundamental reality, which was that they were enslaved, they were slaves, and that we should be confronting not, you know, our own guilt and how we think about and use the terminology, but confronting the raw and brutal evil that was part of the system. And so the more we can focus on understanding and dealing with that evil and dealing with it, I think, rawly through using the real raw terms, you know, the better and the closer to reality we're going to get. And as to whether, you know, the slaves were heroes, you know, I don't really use that term very much in my book. Mm-hmm. But you know, I guess perhaps that's my youthful enthusiasm for their stories.
We only have about a minute left, Dan, but I did want to ask you, you know, in the publisher's press release, they note that with the race once again central to the national conversation, your book has the potential to fundamentally alter the way we view some of the darkest chapters in American history. And in the long run, the aftermath of Katrina and its impact on New Orleans and on the black population there would have been a potential bookend. And this episode in New Orleans history is not incorporated into your thoughts about it.
Yeah, you know, Katrina, you know, you know, many of these issues are still alive today. You know, mm-hmm. the tremendous racial tensions in New Orleans, the question of, you know, order and law versus, you know, a more fundamental reaction in the streets. And, mm-hmm. you know, we saw some brutal vigilante justice, not dissimilar from what happened in 1811 enforced in the streets of Katrina. And so I think there are, you know, really a lot of contemporary resonances to this story.
Okay. Dan Rasmussen, author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.